Welcome to the Freer Thinking Podcast. I'm your guide, Adriel Lewis, a curator with the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Center. It is often said that cooking is an art, and it's also true that art can reveal many stories about food, drinks, and the good manners to consume them politely. That's what this episode is about. We're not going to be all well-pressed shirts and pinkies in the air. We'll start, like many good meals, by simply setting the table, but with a special 12th century plate that talks back. Imagine, you're having a nice meal at a friend's place, and the final course is served. This beautiful, bright white plate comes out, and it's covered with delicious almonds and a variety of dried fruits. You and your friends are all chatting casually, and as you reach across the table to take that last handful of almonds off the dish, you realize the plate itself is speaking to you. Where the food was, now you see that the black designs on the plate are actually highly stylized calligraphy. It's a plate with a message.
In this particular case, it's, "He who professes the faith will excel. To whatever you accustom yourself, you'll grow accustomed to." And then it has a blessing for the owner.
Julian Raby is director of the Freer and Sackler Galleries of Art. This white plate with the elaborate scripted design is from the 12th century. Back then, a group called the Samanids ruled what is now largely northeastern Iran. The Samanid rulers made Persian the official language of the land and ushered in a period of prosperous trade and increased literacy.
So I would imagine a home where you might find these plates actually to be remarkably modest. You can imagine adobe walls, maybe in whitewashed, almost no decoration, no table, and very, very, very little furniture. The way that the food is served is on a big cloth, could be a leather or textile, and then the plates would be put on that.
The family that owned this plate would have been Muslim.
You ate, as people still do, with your right hand only and using three fingers. And it's actually described as how the Prophet Muhammad ate. So there's a religious element to the etiquette of eating.
The plate's graceful script is a reminder.
It's an exhortation to restraint, to a kind of morality. It's actually a visible embodiment of that restraint.
As Islam spread out across the region, more and more people read the Quran, the Muslim holy book, and learned to write too. Plates like this one were not decorated with direct quotations from the Quran, because placing food in the words of the Quran is sacrilegious. But the plates in this collection teach the good manners of Islam. And they all came from the same town, Nishapur, right at the foot of the Binalud Mountains in northeastern Iran. To the far left of the dish we've been discussing, there's a deeper plate. It has thick, brown and black designs, almost woven together. It reads,
"He who is pleased with his own opinion runs into danger." So essentially that's exhorting you and anybody else in the room to kind of listen to what the other people are saying, not just to prattle on with your own opinions.
Yeah, I think that plate you would just give to the person who keeps on dominating the conversation at the party.
Well, maybe not. Maybe that's not the right etiquette, that you show your restraint and you hope others, the guests, do as well. But one of the restraints you do is not to tell the guest off. And there are actually stories relating to the Prophet relating precisely to that.
So no passive-aggressive plate giving as a host. Now that we've gathered a few tips about how to set the table and be a polite guest, we're ready to handle the unique and thoughtfully crafted tea bowls of ancient Japan. At first glance, the three darkly glazed bowls in front of you might seem a little plain. There are no specific designs decorating the outsides, and the shapes are somewhat nondescript. But there's a lot more to consider when evaluating a tea bowl. The first thing, remember that the matcha that went into these, the tea, it was bright green.
It's the color of new spring leaves. It's that kind of bright, alive green color.
Louise Court is the curator for ceramics at the Freer and Sackler Galleries. Unlike British-style tea cups that are uniform, part of a set, and typically have handles, a tea bowl is more like a unique frame you'd pick out to highlight a special work of art. Each bowl would hold a single serving of tea.
The amount of tea that can be drunk in typically 3 sips. In a bowl like this, you have to peer over the rim to see down to the bottom where the green tea is there in this bright green pool. And so the sculpting of a tea bowl is really all about creating a little universe in which the tea is perceived down at the bottom.
There's one darkly glazed bowl in this group of three that was made by a famous sword polisher named Hanami Koetsu. He was well known as an amateur potter.
You could draw a connection between swords and the way bowls like this bowl that Koetsu made were made, because they weren't thrown on the potter's wheel. They were sculpted using bits of sharpened bamboo, or possibly even by this time, bits of sharpened metal. So part of the experience of holding a bowl like this is feeling, not so even seeing so much as feeling, the subtle undulations of the clay walls that result from the way it was made.
Tea was served in a room that was typically about 10 by 10 feet and with a floor lined with thick straw pads with woven reed coverings called tatami mats. The smallness of the tea room would have been especially nice on a cold day in 16th century Japan, when a charcoal fire heating an iron kettle of water in there would have been the only source of warmth.
Chanoyu means hot water for tea. What we call the tea ceremony, began in this very compact space as a way of concentrating the number of people and their interaction with one another, concentrating their relationship to the utensils that were used to make the tea, and then concentrating the experience of watching the tea being made and then receiving the bowl of tea and drinking the bowl of tea, so that people could put everything else out of their minds for the time when they were in that room and space and just think about the tea itself.
There might have been some flowers in an alcove in that room and a hand-painted scroll chosen specifically by the host to spark a particular conversation. This style of tea drinking involves a lot of crafting and thoughtfulness. The host takes whole dried tea leaves and grinds them into a fine powder. A couple small scoops of tea powder are gathered up with a graceful bamboo spoon and added to an individual tea bowl. Then it's time to mix. Steaming hot water joins the tea powder and a delicate bamboo whisk swirls everything together. And although chanoyu became popular in the 16th century, formal and informal versions continue today, with many types of tea bowls bringing new green universes of matcha bubbling to life.
There is very strong interest among young Japanese today in making tea a part of our world today, not just getting dressed up in kimono and pretending to live in the 16th century. None of us sits on tatami very much anymore, and it's hard on our bodies to try to fold our legs that way. So looking for a Western style or a modern style nowadays involving chairs and tables. That's a rather amazing aspect of tea, that it has this capacity to meet its time as a way to create a space that's a beautiful space for drinking tea.
Just as drinking tea has endured through the ages, so too has the drinking of beverages with a little more kick. The two silver cups in front of you represent the introduction of grape wine to China. But before we get into that, let's be clear. The Chinese were enjoying fermented drinks way before grape wine arrived. They drank wine made from fermented grains a long ways back.
The older tradition of grain beverages going all the way back to the Neolithic period continues in China to this day.
Keith Wilson is curator of ancient Chinese art at the Freer and Sackler Galleries.
It's kind of like the Chinese version of a sake, rice wine, distilled rice grain beverage, or sorghum, millet, made from a number of different grains. Maybe those were a little bit more for consumption with your family as opposed to if you were going to have a rich banquet.
Along came the 3rd and 4th centuries, and in comes grape wine from the West.
Western China was very cosmopolitan, open to cultures that spread across Asia as far as the Mediterranean.
Imported wine became a lot more popular, and so did these silver cups.
From the beginning, utensils that were used for presenting it, consuming it, were also kind of imported along with the beverage. The sense that with this luxury foreign good, you needed to consume it with a luxury foreign vessel.
So let's talk about the cups themselves. When I've had sake, that rice wine is served in small ceramic cups that people typically hold with both hands. But these cups are really different.
Well, to our modern eyes, a cup of this shape with a single handle immediately calls to mind a teacup or a coffee cup, right?
If this sounds like a trick question, it's because it is. Imagine steaming tea in a silver teacup. The metal would have gotten way too hot to hold. These silver cups were definitely not meant for hot beverages.
The one with the thumb rest on top has this very beautiful fluted decoration that's kind of spiraling on the sides from the rim to the foot. This is actually an imported cup. It's not made in China. It's believed to have been made in Central Asia, in a region that at that point was ruled by the Confederation of Princes of Sogdiana.
The Sogdians were responsible for a lot of commerce along the Silk Road, and also for early art and craft production.
So not only were they making objects out of precious metal like gilt silver, we know, for example, that the Sogdians were also winemakers, wine merchants.
So the first cup in this case has these alternating silver-toned waves running down the sides. The other cup has a similar shape, but the designs are far more detailed.
If you look at the patterns very closely, you'll see that there are actually renditions of grapevines that cover the sides of the cup from the lip to the foot. The all-over pattern, which kind of sends your eye traveling around the cup, is something that we see earlier on the decoration of ceramic cups for domestic use, the consumption of tea, for example. So I think what we're seeing here is a Chinese interpretation or translation of this imported form that would have been a little bit more familiar to a Chinese consumer, but still had that sense of exoticism.
I know that wine types change over the years and with different regions, but do we have any sense of what the preferences were? Like, did they like stuff with a bit more nose or sweeter, drier kinds of wine?
There's absolutely no hard and fast fact behind this. But if you think of fruit wine consumption today in China, not grape wine, but the more indigenous plum wine, you know, there's a taste more for the sweet. And so it makes me wonder if a sweeter, more Riesling style of grape wine would have been popular at the time.
It's easy to imagine enjoying many silver cupfuls of sweet grape wine and then suffering for it the next morning. Fortunately, there's a meal especially suited for those who have overindulged the night before. That's brunch. The popular late breakfast meal gives guests a chance to sleep off those poor choices they made. What you might not realize is the link between brunch and one of the best-known artists of the Freer Gallery, James McNeill Whistler. The Peacock Room is an expression of the creative ambition of the American painter James McNeill Whistler. He redecorated this room for a British collector named Frederick Leyland. Many years later, the founder of the Freer Gallery of Art purchased the whole room and relocated it to his home in Detroit. And later still, when the museum was built, the Peacock Room was given a space all its own. Whistler painted peacock patterns of blues and golds and greens to set off the blue and white china that would have filled the shelves when Leyland owned the place. In Whistler's own home, he had masses of blue and white china. That's what he used when he entertained guests. He was acutely aware of style, a smart salesman, and in some ways ahead of his time.
He really recognized that as a modern artist, he needed to have an image as much as quality work. And so you were sort of buying that image of the artist as much as the painting itself.
That's Lee Glazer, curator of American art at the Freer. Whistler definitely had quite an image, but not only because he was an American living in London.
Whistler was distinctive looking. He was 5'3", with piercing blue eyes, and supposedly had a cackling laugh like a peacock. He had a big head of curly brown hair, and one of his distinctive features was he had a preternaturally white forelock. Was genetic. His sister apparently had one too. But it was sort of like his trademark, and so he was known for tying it up with a red ribbon to make it stand up.
So the artist was seemingly a work of art himself. He began hosting midday breakfasts, aka brunches, as a way to open up his art studio to wealthy patrons and potential buyers. He liked to entice people to come on by and relax over a meal. His signature dish? Buckwheat pancakes.
It got started probably because it was cheaper to have people to breakfast than it was to have them to dinner. It probably would have been considered unconventional, but that was part of the fun and part of the appeal. And so, of course, if you're trying to attract these society people, the idea of dipping a toe in kind of bohemian artist life was part of it. Now, he would invite them for noon, but the stories are that he would often kind of disappear to take his bath and would keep people waiting until about 1:30.
I guess to be fashionably late was a thing in Whistler's time, too. Even if Whistler wasn't present from the start of his parties, his efforts were immediately visible. He often placed elaborate, handwritten menus on the table so that as guests arrived, at least they could read about what they were waiting for.
He would work very carefully developing a menu, and he would write the menu out in his very distinctive handwriting, often signing it with his butterfly signature, with a butterfly rather than his name. Actually, at the University of Glasgow, which has a lot of Whistler's papers, there are just stacks and stacks, hundreds of these menus for virtually every dinner or breakfast that he ever hosted.
Although the room might be missing its hosts for a while and the table missing its food for a while, Whistler always had visuals in mind. And at his house, he left no shortage of sights to behold.
There are reports that occasionally the table would be laid with nothing but blue and white Chinese porcelain and then a goldfish swimming in a bowl in the middle of the table. And all of it was really just done, I think, to elicit effect, but also to kind of startle people and to get them to pay attention to their surroundings.
Once Whistler made his arrival, guests pretty quickly forgot the wait they'd just endured.
He would buzz around and was very sociable and was a great storyteller and loved to sort of hold the floor. So actually, if you came in and were a little hungover and not feeling at your sharpest, that was just fine because he didn't really want anyone competing. He wanted to amuse and to be the center of attention.
And Lee notes that Whistler took brunch even a step further. He was so delighted by aesthetics, sometimes he even dyed the food he served to emphasize the colors on his table.
Sometimes, for example, the potatoes would be tinted green to contrast with the blue and white porcelain.
And what would Whistler think of the success of brunch today?
What would Whistler make of brunch today? He'd probably enjoy sipping a mimosa with the right people. And the whole experience of kind of obsessing over food and where did it come from and what does it look like, all of that is really a kind of outgrowth of this aestheticism that he pioneered. I think that he always liked being in control. And so going to a restaurant where perhaps the chef is the main attraction and not Whistler wouldn't appeal to him so much.
Whether we go out to eat in restaurants or serve up meals from home, the objects and art surrounding us and surrounding our main course, they carry many stories. And all these stories about food can make a guy hungry. Given that the curators from the Freer and Sackler galleries traversed the globe pursuing their research, it wouldn't be right not to ask them about their memorable meals. So here's a little bonus segment that may, well, if your hunger was growing, this could curb it.
It really was a memorable ice cream, and it was prune and Armagnac, and so it was just this really intense, heady flavor, and you don't usually think about sweets having that umami taste, but it almost had that, and
You know, I mean, I can close my eyes and still remember what it tasted like.
The bravest food, sheep's eyeballs. It was a shock. They're not particularly pleasant. I mean, maybe you've eaten fish eyeballs. Yeah, so there's always that sort of hard bit that you come at the end, and nasty.
Ooh, sea slugs. Chinese sea slugs, it's a delicacy in South China. Not one of my favorites.
Silkworm larva in northeast Thailand. Interviewing women who were weavers who were reeling silk, and the leftover worms are eaten by them. So I had one.
If that doesn't inspire some freer thinking, well, you can always check out another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.